Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Okay, everybody, welcome back to One Broken Mom. I have with me one of my favorite guests. It's Lara Curry, and she was on with one of my episodes that I got a lot of really great feedback about, and it was micro boundary violations. And I don't know, Lara, if anybody reached out to you or anything, but like I said, several of my listeners actually really responded to that conversation that we had about how people can infiltrate our defenses and totally set our lives askew. And so having you back on the show was actually great, because what I wanted to do today was actually really dig into your true expertise, which is in the field of working with high conflict businesses and organizations and having difficult conversations. I mean, you have a podcast show yourself called Difficult Happens. And so to have you in and help us talk and learn a little bit about, you know, when we have these. I mean, I think everybody knows that difficult conversations can be spontaneous. They can just show up in our face. It can be at a meeting in a, you know, at the company or with friends, and something might just get lobbed onto the table that requires you to respond in some capacity or witness it in some way. And then difficult conversations can also be the things that are planned, like you're going into a performance review. And this is the end of the year when we're recording this. And so some people might start to, you know, get the sense of, you know, we got to go in, we got to talk to the boss, we got to talk to some coworkers. Maybe we're asking for a raise, which can feel really difficult for people. Or you might be in a management position yourself and you have to have a not so flattering conversation with a subordinate or a teammate. And again, this could even be difficult conversations with friends. And I know this might seem for folks that are used to jumping into One Broken Mom and having a raw conversation about shitty childhoods and, you know, and all that stuff.
We can do that too.
We can do that. We'll totally do that. And so this might feel a little off topic, but, you know, in reality is that, you know, we do have jobs or we do engage with non-family people pretty regularly, and our bodies and nervous systems do respond differently to different people depending on what their roles are in our lives. And to some extent, if they happen to have some familiar characteristics in them that do trigger old defense mechanisms, which are based on those shitty childhood experiences and stuff. So I want you to start off. We talked about this on the micro boundary episode, but I'd like for you to introduce this again. We do respond to different people depending on their roles in our lives, right?
Absolutely. There's so much involved when we are interacting with someone, and especially when it comes to like awkward or difficult conversations. It depends on what your relationship is. You know, if you're a peer of mine, then the conversation is going to go a certain way. And our conflicts or our awkwardness around each other will be for different reasons. If you are the boss, you know, if you're in a power position, then automatically there are different rules to conversations and to interactions. So when conflict does crop up, it matters whether you're in that power position, the peer position, or the pupil position, you know, which is like the one down position. Because that, you know, you're not going to go tell your boss, you're not going to have conversations with your boss in the way that you would a subordinate or a peer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, we talked about this on an episode that I did with you. So it wasn't on One Broken Mom, but I want us to introduce this, which is we do have conflict personality types that, you know, tend to drive our behaviors and how we engage with people, especially when pressed into a difficult situation. It's like a defense mechanism. Explain what those conflict personality types are that you've identified and work with organizations on, and how we might try to figure out which one and which category we might fall into.
Yeah, you know, we all know like our Myers-Briggs or our Colby or our DISC, you know, there's personality types out there for everything. There's a test for just about everything because we all kind of want to know ourselves in a deeper way. And we all want our individualness to be, to mean something that's different from other people. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like with your Myers-Briggs, I'm an intuitive, right? I'm a highly sensitive intuitive. I might meet other highly sensitive intuitives, but they're going to be different from me because then they also have, like, let's say maybe they are a little more on the, do you know the Colby scale?
I don't know Colby. I haven't taken the Colby scale.
I love that one. But okay. It's basically all about how you work and interact with other people, right? All the tests are helpful to the extent that if you agree with them or if they resonate with you, great, they're helpful. Otherwise, they're just useless.
Right.
That's why I absolutely love them and they're completely pointless at the same time. They do help you understand yourself a little bit better. But when some people will use them as an excuse to say, well, what are you going to do? I'm an intuitive, so I'm just going to walk around feeling all the time.
Right. Yeah. And as I do like a predictive index is one that I use quite a bit because I'm actually the day job outside of this is I'm the director of recruiting for an organization. And so we do use these personality tests. And Colby's not one. I'm going to look it up now that I get off of there. But you're right. It is not a catch-all excuse maker. Oh, nor is it a box for you to put everybody in around you. So.
So when it comes to your conflict personality type, that is something that comes up only when you're in conflict. So you can have, you know, it's like the love languages, you can have a dominant kind of personality type outside of conflict, but then once conflict happens, what's your go-to? So that's what the conflict personality type is. So think about when you're in those difficult situations or when you're feeling fearful. There are four different types, and they are the perfectionist controller. Now, I say perfectionist controller because they manifest internally and externally. So you think of perfectionism, that's really an internal thing, right? But when it manifests externally, it's a controlling thing. So it has two sides. It's sort of like it has many sides, like a icosahedron. But so you think of perfectionism and controlling. And then the second one is the pleaser fixer. And the third one is the innocent avoider. And the final one is victim blamer. So when you are under stress, what is your go-to? Do you go right to trying to control the situation? Or, you know, if you're a perfectionist, kind of blaming yourself and what you've done wrong? Or if you're a pleaser, you know, do you go right to trying to make everybody and placate everything or fix everybody else's problems? Or again, innocent avoider. That's just like, I don't know what's going on here. I'm out of here. just kind of like ghosts. Mm-hmm. And then the victim blamer is, well, you don't understand where I'm coming from. You have no idea, you know, blaming the situation on, it could be anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be your childhood. It could be the situation. And we've all done all of these. That's just part of humanity. But think about when you are in a conflict. What's the first one that comes up? What's your go-to? Mm-hmm. And that's your conflict personality type.
And I was sitting there thinking about that because I was, you know, listening and like, God, you know, it depends on the conflict, but if I feel like there is an injustice happening, then I'm in a defensive mode, either defending my position or defending something else. But it feels more like I've heard this term before used, which is with a assertiveness communication, which is a sword, you know, bring it out and start to wage war. It can be very dominating. It can be very telling. It can be very direct, you know, and almost, you know, almost too direct, you know, like a sword can be, in terms of just like laying out everybody in the room. And that used to be an old version of me of, you know, standing into that. I think like right now, you know, I pause a lot more with it, but I can see myself wanting to, blame in terms of having a lot of reasons behind choices and actions and defending that. So I feel like I keep landing on a defensive position for me with that. But I do change because, you know, I can be very commanding in some certain situations. And then if depending on the topic can then just become wilted and weak and people pleasing, like easily people pleasing, which just doesn't feel like that's a natural state for me. But yet you know? And I say that specifically when it comes to, in the past, when it came to money and setting prices and, you know, asserting value, like dollar values for services or asking for a raise or, you know, wanting to get compensation and becoming the people pleaser, like instantly, you know, when somebody goes, yeah, I don't think we can do that. Oh, okay. That's fine. You know, which is weird.
Yeah. It's very, it's also intricate. It's all interlaced, you know, so it depends on your relationship with the person. It depends on what exactly you're discussing, like you said, about finances. You know, if there are certain topics that trigger different reactions in people. My husband can talk about finances, no problem. We can work out the budget. He's got no problem. He's like, it's just maths. You know, we just got to figure this out. And I'm like, just put the numbers away, get them out of my face. I don't want to, you know, it just triggers me to, you know, it's like, ah, taxes, you know?
Right, right. Well, now, so how do we know? I mean, where we, how do we switch gears to figure out where we land, you know, on this conflict personality type? I mean, is there a sensation or something that we will note that happens? I mean, does it happen in the moment that we suddenly go, oh, I'm being a people pleaser right now? Or is it something that you go, shit, I left the meeting an hour ago and realized I people pleased the crap out of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the first step. You know, you always got to look back to move forward. And I really like looking at past situations, like especially past situations that didn't go well, and breaking down why they didn't go well. Where was the trigger point for me? You know, what got me flustered? And a lot of dysfunctional people, and I'll just claim the title right now because I was raised in dysfunction and trauma, like you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people like us, we will almost separate from ourselves during conflict because it's a protection mechanism. We'll do one of two things that, you know, that defensive will bring up our anger and our rage, mm-hmm. which is a great protector. Fear and anger are, they're synonymous with each other. Yeah. Once you're fearful, your anger comes to the forefront because that's your armor. That's what's going to fight your fights for you. Well, you know, your brain gets out of there and is protected. So, or sometimes we just kind of disassociate, and it's only in looking back. It's like, wow, did I really, you know, I remember once having a conversation with my sister, and it was a very difficult conversation. I thought I was being calm and rational. And my other sister, there are three of us, said, why are you so angry? And I'm like, I'm not angry. I'm just being clear. But apparently I had been talking like this. You know, it's like, oh, I thought I was being clear. And it's like, that's a lot of rage coming from you, Laura. You know? So just kind of looking back and saying, oh, okay, I was scared to have that conversation. So my anger came up to protect me in a certain way. And then just kind of rewrite in your mind, what would have been the best case scenario? How would I have liked that conversation to go? What would have been a perfect outcome? And what can I do differently next time? Now, sometimes people will trip themselves up because they will have a million intentions. Okay, I want to get this across, and I want them to feel this way, and I want them to understand this. It's like, no, you can't do that. You have to have one intention when you're going into a difficult situation. You can't have a litany of them. So especially when it comes to like difficult conversations, what's one thing that you want to accomplish, and how are you going to get there? And how are you going to know when it's going off the rails? You know, I think we talked before about where it lives in your body, where that anxiety or anger or fear lives. And for me, it's my neck and shoulders and my stomach. Mm-hmm. So I know that once those are getting tight or are starting to react, that something's going on. Mm-hmm. And so I just got to take a beat and go, okay, what's really going on here? Is it internal? Is it external? What's up?
Mm-hmm. Now, is there, when we talk about conflict personality types, is there some science or information about why we end up evolving into one or several of these, you know, in different scenarios and different situations? Because I feel like that's obviously a worthwhile reflection too, of like, why would I behave in this way with this situation or with this type of a person? And where would that be maybe stemming from?
You know, I think that it goes back to that you have the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn mm-hmm. reactions when you're in difficult situations or when you're in traumatic situations. I think the fawning, how it has manifested for you or how it has worked for you in the past, it's simply that's your go-to. So like for me, I'm a bit of a perfectionist in real life, but when it comes to conflict personality, I'm a pleaser all the way. And I'm a pleaser because that's what's worked for me. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up, any kind of difficult situation that I would get in, if I was funny or if I would smile or what, you know, whatever it would be, that's what worked. And so that's what got nurtured. And, you know, that became the queen of the castle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I sat and, you know, it many times in my own personal life, which is why I think I ended up, you know, like I've crowned myself as the queen of self-sabotage, because I have not capitulated probably as many times as I should have, like just out of sheer stubborn defiance, you know, which has been, you know, to some extent my defense mechanism, which was just, you know, not bowing down, you know. And it doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't opportunities and difficulties to find common ground, you know, with everybody here. And I think that that's what gets lost in the kind of the spirit and the heat of the moment when we're engaged in conflict, is how to pull back and figure out how to kind of save that situation. Saving it, maybe not, but sometimes you have to be the person that saves the situation, especially if you're dealing with everybody else's conflict personalities, mm-hmm. and it is going off the rails really pretty quickly, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes down to, we all just want to be seen. We all just want to be seen for who we really are and who we are, like in a difficult conversation or an argument or in any conversation. What we're basically doing is saying, this is how I see myself. Will you see me like this? That's basically mm-hmm. what we're doing. And so in a conflict, what we really are doing is, I am hurt, afraid, whatever the emotion is, and I want you to know about it, and I want you to see it like I see it. And so sometimes just acknowledging the way that someone sees something can be enough for them to, you know, step back. I was in a, I think this was a court case a couple years ago when I was a guardian for high conflict divorces. I was a guardian for the kids. And there was a conversation going on, and the mother and father, you know, I had talked to the mom about how just acknowledge what he's saying to you, because he, you know, it's the argument back and forth. Just acknowledge what he's been saying to you. So she did. She, you know, basically repeated what he had said, and he must have said it like three or four more times and in three or four different ways, because he wanted to make sure, you know, that this wasn't just a, did you really see me? And it just diffused the whole thing. He sat back, he felt heard, and he felt seen, and they were able to continue on with the topic at hand that we were, whatever it was that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. But that's sometimes just that enough, that alone is enough to calm the situation down. And then you could still get your intention out there, you know, but they're just diffused a little bit. Defensive behavior brings about defensive behavior. Mm-hmm. So if you get defensive, take a beat and think about what you're defensive about, because if you calm down, it might just diffuse the entire situation.
Right. And, you know, you brought up the point of being able to look around the room and also see if you can't identify the conflict personality of the person that, or the persons in the room that you're engaging with. And I know that for, you know, like I said, for me, that comes from experience and maturity and growth, you know, a lot of growth in that area of like knowing how I'm going to be triggered, what areas I might be triggered. And that's why I think it's important to try to figure out where you lean, because that's a, you know, to some extent, that's going to be hardwired into you. That's going to be really tough to change, but you can at least change how you respond after that by taking that moment of breath or knowing as you go in, like, gosh, you know, I'm going to engage with a certain person, or I'm going into this room. And this happens to me quite a bit. You know, I go into a room with other people that aren't going to be as strong-willed, you know, and kind of big personality that I might be, especially if I, you know, passionate about whatever it might be. And I intentionally scale back because I know that this person that's sitting to the left of me over here tends to do this when pushed. And I know this person over here needs to do this in order to make sure they feel seen. And I know this person here is, you know, whatever. And so it's identifying those landmines before walking in or starting the, you know, so that you can, not get to a place of a conflict, you know, try to eliminate that. Are there skills in which somebody could learn to do that, to be able to see around the room and look for certain behaviors and prepare them for that? Because we don't want our legs blown off by stepping on a landmine we could have avoided, you know?
Yeah. I think the knowing thyself, you know, that's the greatest thing, but also knowing that there are certain, so like if you're a pleaser, then the opposite conflict personality type to you is going to be the victim. And those two get into more conflicts because the pleaser is trying to fix everything from the victim. And the victim just wants to be seen and heard and understood, right? They don't want it fixed. Mm-hmm. And it's the same for the perfectionist and the avoider. Those two have a dance of their own. And so if you know that going in, you can kind of set up, like you say, if there's a victim that you happen to know who's in the room, make sure that they're seen. Make sure that they get a chance to show who they are and to say their piece. And make sure that the pleaser doesn't jump in and try and fix whatever's wrong. But just, hey, she's just saying it or whatever. So it really depends on the context, on the topics that you're talking about. If it's talking about feedback, like let's say you're going through and you're giving feedback, everybody wants to, we all make mistakes, but everybody wants people to understand why they made that mistake. A perfectionist is going to have a lot of different reasons why. And so knowing that going in and knowing, you know, how you're going to handle that, what your one intention is, and also how you can have them be seen and respected and not feel ashamed, but still understand that things need to change. And it's the same for the victim or the avoider and the pleaser. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now, if we're sitting here, you know, talking about the fact, again, there's difficult conversations that are spontaneous and those that are planned. And I think sometimes too, people find themselves in situations where they don't really get to guide the tone of the conversation. It's not theirs. It's not their meeting they started. It's not their interview. It's not their whatever the case may be. And yet, so they end up feeling that they have to go with the flow that's being set and the tone that's being set for maybe somebody that has a little less awareness and sympathy or intuitiveness as to what's going on there. How do we gain control of a situation in which we are not in the power seat to guide that situation? Does that question make sense to you?
Yeah, I think it does. And the first thing that came to mind is to slow things down and ask questions. So you can do a lot of clarifying and verifying that can direct. So like, let's say that there's a way that you see things and you see that things are going to go off the rails a little bit over here and the leader or the boss or whoever it is, it isn't picking up on it. You can stop and say, let me ask a question or can I clarify something in a way that might raise awareness to where that leader might cue in on what's mm-hmm. going on. So asking questions or also validating what other people said, you know, saying, Marie, I loved what you said about XYZ. Because it impacts XYZ. So making sure that people who often don't have a voice or who aren't heard, that you recognize that, hey, I heard what you said and I liked what you said. So sometimes you can just take on those positions in a way that's not taking over the meeting, but it's mm-hmm. in acknowledging mm-hmm. and in slowing things down if you need to.
Yeah. Now, what happens when we end up working with people that are just dense, you know, yeah. or, you know, and I don't mean that in an intelligent standpoint, but they just, their social intelligence is a little on the low side. And that's going to happen. You know, we wish that we were around a bunch of people with amazing high EQs and social intelligence quotients, but that's just not the reality. And especially mm-hmm. if we feel, I would say in a powerless situation, like maybe it's a supervisor or a team, you know, let's do that. Let's talk about, you know, what if our boss just has, you know, a relatively low EQ and social intelligence and you are just like, you know, feel like you're dealing with a brick wall. And I mean that in the sense that my experience with other people has been some people are really hard on other people. Like they feel that leadership and management is to be a jerk and to be really hostile with their feedback. And that's not necessarily the case. It's not how you get that. But if you're in that situation where you're gearing up for that, you know, is there a way to shift that mode or do you have to just go in and take it?
One of the best ways that I've handled this in the past is that when someone especially is, you know, angry and they have a lot of unrealistic expectations of you and they're laying the law, is to kind of stop them and say, you seem really angry. You seem really upset. Is there something going on? And just acknowledging it, kind of like my sisters did with me, you know, when they're like, what's with all the anger? And actually, I think this is what's with the rage, because I just didn't know it. I didn't see it. And then make sure that you follow it up with examples. But some examples like, you know, you said this and it seemed very harsh, or this seemed to be your intention. However, when you do this, it gets my defenses up, you know, or whatever it is that's happening. And if that doesn't work, if they're still so dense, you can just say, when you talk to me like that, it's really inappropriate. It's filled with anger, judgment, whatever it is. Can you please, and then insert whatever it is that you want or the way that you want them to talk?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if it's an ongoing problem, you know, get HR involved.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now what you said is beautiful and brilliant, and it makes a lot of sense. And I know that there's probably half the people listening here goes, that sounds great, but I can't do that. Like, I can't stop somebody who's yelling at me and tell them that they're acting inappropriate. I mean, like, that's like the essence of assertiveness that a lot of people really do struggle with, you know, how to confidently express their needs and their wants and their desires, you know, in a conversation. And so what happens if you know you need to say that, but you just can't summon the strength to be able to do that? How do you change that about yourself? Because it really is not okay, you know, to feel like you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But people don't know how to take the first step to changing that for themselves, to become the type of person that could, while they're being screamed and yelled at, you know, put the stop sign up and gain control of the momentum of the way the meeting or the conversation is going.
Yeah. It's sort of like explaining to someone how to drive a car and then saying, okay, go ahead. You know, it's not going to happen all at once. You have to practice it, and you have to practice it in safe environments. I call this the same yours theory, because my sister Megan, when she was in high school, she was in the girls' bathroom, and high school girls and girls' bathroom, nothing but mayhem, right? There's no good happening there. Mm-hmm. And there were a bunch of girls picking on her. And she had just had enough. You know, she was just done with it. And she turned around and said, same yours. And they were like, what? They were kind of confused. She just walked out of the bathroom. So she had finally, you know, built up the courage to say something, you know, to stop it. And it came out like that. And it's going to come out like that. You got to practice in safer environments. At the grocery store, if someone, you know, the clerk is, well, I should have an example like right here and ready to go, but say, oh, hey, you know what? I prefer plastic bags. Could you please not use the paper bags? Whatever it is, you know, in smaller ways, assert yourself and just practice. And also you can get a backseat. You know, it might seem like once something has happened and it's done and it's over, and you can never go back and redo it, but you kind of can. You can go back and say, hey, can I give you some feedback? I really felt icky about that meeting and the way it went. Do you mind if I talk to you about it? You know, or there's a lot of different ways that you could kind of get a backseat, you know, a take back on how something went. And mm-hmm. sometimes that's how you practice. Mm-hmm. You just go back and say, hey, I didn't like the way that conversation went between the two of us. Do you mind if we try again? Or do you mind if I say something? Or do you have anything more you want to say to me?
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're working with organizations and teams and stuff like that, do you have skills trainings or activities and exercises that you have people do? Because in a room, you will find a variety of people that are able to talk through, you know, a difficult conversation, from the person that will charge right in and have no fear of the outcomes for it. And, you know, I feel like I'm that way. It's like, you know, there are no hurdles too tall for me to scale. And so I'm willing to attack and tackle, all the way from people that would just rather leave the room and go back to their cubicle. But we all have to be able to, in those situations, kind of adjust into some sort of like a happy medium. So how do you work with people to get them to some consistency that's acceptable in terms of how we express what we need to say in the midst of, you know, a conflict situation?
Yeah. There's a couple of different things I do depending on how, depending on the teams and the dynamic. But one of the things that I like to do is have people do opposite to action. So they kind of take on the personality that is the opposite of them. So we do an intention sheet. So it talks about what their position is, what their conflict personality type is, what the triggering event is. Like, is it the topic? Is it the way someone comes at you? Is it the atmosphere? Is it words? You know, whatever the triggering event is. And then to take on that opposite, meaning that what they don't want to deal with, then they become that. And it kind of empowers them a little bit. But it also, for people who like go in and take charge, it can be a little eye-opening that, oh, okay, this is what that looks like from the other side. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I, for the people that I have, like, I have the greatest sympathy for, the people that don't say anything ever, you know, and when I talk about self-sabotage, you know, many times a lot of people, you know, assume that you know, the biggest part of self-sabotage is shooting off your mouth and saying something that you know you shouldn't have, but you couldn't control it and you did it anyways. But there on the other end of the spectrum, there's also the never saying anything at all. And that, you know, can end up hurting you in the long run. And it feels like what you're doing, you know, the benefit you think you're getting from that experience is like, hey, I'm just not trying to ruffle any feathers. So I'm just going to, and I think you talked about that, like being the avoider, like mm-hmm. that's not the, you know, always the best solution to difficult situations. So how do you take somebody whose natural tendency is to just back out of the room and go away to change their mindset maybe, and to allow them to know that it is okay to participate. And sometimes it is appropriate to participate, not always be running for the door.
The first thing is when it comes to avoiders, oftentimes they don't really even know what it is that they're uncomfortable with because they've spent so much time avoiding. So the very first thing is to identify what's going on and what they don't like, and especially around shame type stuff. So if something is happening and they're like, oh, I don't want to get involved in this because, and then they have some internal story, they've got some script that they've told themselves over and over. Maybe it's because that means this about me. If I do say something, then that would mean I am this type of person, or, you know, whatever it is that they don't want to be. So at the very first, they just need to get to know what it is exactly that they don't like, what it is exactly that they're afraid of. And that can take time. You know, sometimes you just say, well, I don't know, I just don't like conflict. Okay, what do you not like about conflict? Is it the conflict itself? Is it the raised voices? Is it the confrontation, the one-on-one? What exactly is it? Is it the topic that you don't want to talk about? Sometimes just identifying that is the very first step in order mm-hmm. to be able to voice, because you have to know what you want to voice.
Mm-hmm. It seems like if you're sitting here listening to the show and you feel like that's the person that you would be, that now, you know, moving forward from, you know, listening to this and then going to work on Monday would be to start to just journal, you know, when you feel that way and kind of taking note. Like, you don't have to do anything right away. And I think that's one thing too that, you know, frightens people is, you know, they suddenly have to like flip a switch and become assertive tomorrow, that it is a long process that, you know, starts. And for that, it would be to sit down and go, today I wanted to say something, you know. And I know I've talked about this with other guests where they're talking about like, get curious when you want to speak up and then you don't. Mm-hmm. And then why you're not speaking up, because sometimes the shame, like you pointed out, is the fact that they are afraid that if they say something that somebody will get upset with them or mad at them or tell them they're dumb or their idea is stupid, or, you know, all those negative voices, you know, that are in their head, that keep people from stepping in to, you know, saying what they really mean and feel. So I like the idea of sitting back and starting to at least jot for a week when things arose and why you didn't say something when you really did want to say something, and start to get a handle on that. Because you're right, it'll be different. You know, we might say, or behave differently again with our friends while we're sitting there at dinner. And that's the other thing too, is like observation and these opportunities are not just when we go to work, they're everywhere in all of our engagement, with so many people around us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the biggest thing, the biggest takeaway is to give yourself a break, because we all are trying our best and we all fail. I mean, we all have some bar that we want to always be at. It's not going to work. I mean, and what'll happen sometimes, especially if it's a pattern, is that we will judge ourselves for our failures, not for our successes. And it's so important to just take a break and be like, I did this really well, and not focus on, well, I didn't say this when Ben was in my face, and I didn't say this when Sarah took my coffee cup, and I didn't say that, you know, don't beat yourself up too much mm-hmm. because there's always going to be something you can be better at, right? But yeah, hold yourself in grace when you make mistakes or when it's harder than it should be. And yes, journaling 100%. I totally agree about the journaling. I like to journal every once in a while as my best self, meaning I sometimes talk to myself in my journal. You are doing a great job. You did the best. I loved when you did, you know, because that really does, it helps, you know, it helps in the way that you talk to yourself. Because sometimes journaling can just be a, blah, here's all the horrible things that are going on, and, you know, here's what I failed at. And sometimes you can get stuck in that loop too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it helps with the preparation as well too, because you're able to Speaking is so different than writing, Miss Obvious here. But in the sense that at least your brain is processing the thoughts that you want to have and being able to put them down into words first, especially if you are not comfortable with the conversation and you're going to go into it, like you've got the ability to plan, but then not lose sight of the fact that even if you've missed the opportunity, that journaling it or writing it down, what you would have said and why you didn't say it and what you could have said, gives you a chance, right, to be able to, that back piece, to be able to say, you know what, I think these things that I wrote down are really important, and I owe it to myself to follow through with these anyways. And you could even take this sheet of paper and re-engage with a person to have that conversation once you've had a chance to process it. Because not everybody thinks quickly in the heat of the moment either. So, we talk about fight, flight, or freeze. Like, that really does happen. Some people are good on their feet, with handling the problem, whether they're handling it appropriate or not, they're handling the problem. And then some people actually do need some time to be more reflective of it. So is it okay? I mean, should people demand an ability to come back later to a topic if they are the type that really does need to take it in, walk away, think about it, and then come back with, the second go?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, if you can say something like, you've given me a lot to think about, can I get back to you on that? Sometimes that alone is enough to give you the breathing room. And it also gives you that open door to where you said, yeah, you've given me a lot to think about. Can I get back to you? And I'm going to come back to you with my thoughts gathered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, sometimes again, writing it out, preparing yourself ahead of time and doing them in small incremental ways. Like, you don't have to change everything. Like, I probably, for somebody that has had some assertiveness difficulty, wouldn't make the first go around the one that they're going to go ask for like the $30,000 a year raise, but to find other small victories that they can lead in with and start with. One thing that I've done, I'm just throwing this out there, is I have started to go into meetings because I'm in a situation that is unlike anything that I've ever been professionally. I cut my teeth in the professional world working with men, like a construction industry, engineering industry. Like, college, I was one of just like two women that graduated in my entire class. Then I went into an engineering firm where most of the women were actually admin and not engineers. And then I got into working in manufacturing. And so, being a little brusque is actually okay, to some extent. Some guys would get upset and offended by it, but the very direct, plain speaking is not something that a lot of people, take issue with. But then, going in into an industry where I work with a bunch of women, I really did have to learn how to, like, okay, not everybody can handle, direct and honest feedback, like this. And so, and that wasn't because I felt like every way I was doing it was correct, but it did allow me to be able to change and alter and say, listen, you get curious about yourself and your delivery system. And do you have to do this all the way? And so I started to go into meetings with setting an intention, which was, I mean no harm. I'm here for you. I'm here to be the best that I can be so that I can support you. And I know that you come into this meeting wanting the same things. And so if I say something, always believe and trust that I mean no harm. So even if it feels, and that changed the dynamic of many of the meetings that we had in there, because I did have some people that were probably more avoiders, were triggered by a stronger presence and, that felt, I don't know, a little intimidating. That's a word that I'm used to. And it let them know that even if I said something very directly, they believed me, that I didn't mean any harm in that. And it totally, changed the dynamic of meetings and things. And I bring that up because I feel like starting that out, giving yourself permission to be the human you're about to be in this meeting, also kind of like, doesn't it give everybody else the same permissions too?
Absolutely. And a good pre-frame, really, it goes a long way, especially if you're a leader or in the power position. Just letting people know, okay, this is how this is going to go. And if you have any questions, what the rules are. Everybody wants to know what the rules are. Also, people want to know how they're perceived. Meaning, if you are, maybe you're a little more brash or a little more upfront. And if I'm more of an avoider or someone who sits back, I want to make sure that you don't see me as someone that can be walked over or someone that's, insignificant in some way. So once I know that, oh, that's just how you talk, or that's just the way that you are, and you mean no harm, it goes a long way for me not, you know, telling stories in my head or, you know, feeling judged in a negative way. Mm-hmm. A good pre-frame goes a long way.
Yeah. Well, and it's not hard to do. So for people that are listening, like, you know, if you've had some difficulties, depending on your organization or your group dynamics, where you just are feeling stifled and unable to, you know, everything is stressful every time you go into it, it's worth putting out there. Because I think the thing that we forget about is that we're all in the same boat, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we all really are not trying to hurt each other. You know, yeah. And when you can be the first person to lead with vulnerability, sometimes it really does just like opens up the air into the room, and it just takes the burden off of everybody, because everybody's probably coming in to this difficult conversation ready to do their role in fighting and protecting for themselves, you know, and their own interest, or like you said earlier in the conversation, that they're wanting to be seen and understood, mm-hmm. and all of that. And if you're able to be the person that just kind of like, again, opens the door and lets the air into the room, it might just, you know, it would go a long way. I mean, I know I've experienced that with that happening there. So are there good ways, you know, a good, good, healthy ways of asserting what it is that we want to say? And are there bad ways of saying what we want to say?
I think making sure that you keep it on yourself. Instead of saying, well, you always take over the meeting, so I want to be sure that I'm heard first or something like that. It's like, well, don't say what other people are doing. Just talk about what you want and how you see things. And if you feel unsure, you can say, you know, I'm trying something new, so can you bear with me? I want to be really clear when I say. Sometimes if you just ask people to cut you some slack ahead of time, they will, you know. Mm-hmm. Or even saying, so this is difficult for me. I don't usually talk about X, Y, Z, you know, letting them know. And sometimes that will make people want to help you, put people in a position to, you know, help shepherd you along, especially if you show a little bit of vulnerability, if it's a safe space to do that. You know what I mean? There are some environments, some offices where it's not safe to be vulnerable. I think mm-hmm. it is in most, though. I mean, most of the groups that I come across, they're just a different type of family dynamic. Mm-hmm. Every group of people is a family dynamic of some sort, whether they're coworkers or actual family.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when you say something like that with the space being safe, you know, that's a word that I've used in other contexts too. I mean, I feel like that's important to understand. So help define safety for that and what that actually means for somebody, because, you know, we should never be in unsafe situations. And you and I both are not talking about physical safety and, you know, that obvious things, but, understanding where safe zones actually exist, because as people that have grown with trauma, we're used to being in unsafe situations. Unsafe is the norm for us, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that it's actually a place that we need to continue to take residence in work yeah. or in life. So help us understand how a person might evaluate whether or not they are in a safe space.
Yeah, especially the first thing is there manipulative behavior in your workplace or in the environment? Does someone use your own thoughts, feelings, or emotions against you? Does someone ever shame or embarrass you or talk down to you? Those are emotionally unsafe spaces. And oftentimes, because it's familiar, if you were raised in trauma and dysfunction, you're used to the passive-aggressive comments or the micromanaging that tries to control your behavior. Or even, like I've talked about on your show before, silence was used in my situations, not only in my household growing up in my family of origin, but by my ex-husband, where he would use silence as punishment for, you know, weeks on end. And so those are manipulative tactics that are used to get something from you in some way, and those are unsafe. And sometimes they just need to be called out. Mm-hmm. Just saying something like, I noticed that you haven't spoken in a week. Is there something going on? Oh, you're still not responding. That's very odd. You know, just whatever it is. Mm-hmm. If you call it out, sometimes you can nip it in the bud, or just let them know, I see you. I see what you're doing. There's this, have you been following the away luggage scandal?
Okay.
I'm such a nerd. I love this stuff. I'm actually going to do a show as a case study about this whole thing. But basically, the boss is there. These two women who founded this company, and it just went. It took off. It got huge, and they had hundreds and hundreds of employees. And they just micromanaged to the point where they had all conversations had to happen on a Slack channel, which is open so that everybody can read it. No emails, no IMs, everything had to take place there. Anything that was done wrong, the boss shamed them publicly on that Slack channel for everybody to see. I mean, it was just so toxic. Just yesterday, I think it was, she stepped down because it just went on for, it got to the point where she wasn't letting people take vacations. She fired groups en masse if she perceived that they were talking about her. I mean, it was just really a toxic environment. And it begets paranoia. It just kind of feeds on itself. And it's sort of like the moldy blueberry. You get one moldy blueberry and it ruins the whole batch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Now, and I feel like, you know, if somebody is going through that and if that's your work environment, to strongly consider changing work environments. And I know, because I've done that before too, where you're just like, I can't
Yeah.
You know, there's no time left in life to tolerate that, because that isn't safe. That isn't healthy. That isn't normal. And, you know, I don't think there's any amount of money you can ever make to allow yourself to be physically and emotionally, you know, bombarded degraded. And drawn down, yeah, and degraded mm-hmm. like that. And so if it's systemic throughout your organization or your company, then it's probably time to go find something else, you know, to do. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think can be a drawback when somebody feels really unable to handle a one-on-one direct conversation with somebody that is going to be difficult and challenging is that instead of doing it directly with another person, they do it indirectly with other people. Which is, and I, you know, I'm not sitting here on my golden throne with my halo saying that I've never done this. In fact, it's been one of my least favorite parts of my personality, that when I found myself in conflict in certain situations, that when I'm not able to get resolution with the person that I'm trying to have the conversation with, then my release vent is to vent it out in the direction towards other people, trying to get some satisfaction from that. But that can actually backfire if that tends to be your MO, and which is, like you described, like that passive aggressive nature, rather than learning, you know, good skills at engaging directly with another person, right? And mm-hmm. if, you know, and that can blow up on you in your workplace if you're the person that's constantly venting or bitching to everybody else, but unwilling to have that conversation. Why do people do that? I mean, I just described why I did it, but have you seen that mm-hmm. in organizations? Because I feel like I have worked with other companies where the back channel talking is all over the place and nobody can get in the same room and solve the problems together. And yet it just breeds this toxic poison throughout the organization because everybody's having all the conversations at the water cooler instead mm-hmm. of handling it right in the room where it needs to be done.
Yeah, classic triangulation. Some of it is because they're in a one down position. They just don't have the power and they don't have the ability to change it. Another reason that I've found is, especially around people who have been raised in dysfunction, is understanding the different levels of friendship. And sometimes when they go into work, they're like, oh, these are my friends. It's like, no, they're friendly coworkers. They don't get to know all of you, you know, and that's a classic where we might overshare with people. And if we happen to overshare with someone who's like a pleaser fixer, they're going to want to triangulate. They're going to want to get in there and fix it for you, or think that they can, you know, all that's really needed is my input into this. When in reality, it just sets up it's a system of failure. It's kind of breeds negativity. Mm-hmm. And unless you have someone who's willing to just listen, just be a sounding board and not incorporate the negativity as fact in their own world, which is pretty rare, right? Whenever you hear stuff, you definitely start to make opinions about it. So,
right. That's why you need a therapist, because that's what they're supposed to do, is to take it in and not impart anything to it. So,
right. Right.
Yeah. Well, and so passive aggressive is not a key form of communication in difficult conversations, right?
Right. Right. We've all done it. Yeah. But it's not, yeah, that's not the way you want to go.
Right. Right. Now, when it comes to, and I know we talked about this on another thing, and I think it bears mentioning in this, is like when you're having difficult conversations, sometimes it will result to you are not going to be able to get out of it. I know you and I've personally talked about our personal experiences outside of the shows on this, where, you know, some people you just cannot get resolution. You cannot get satisfaction out of it. Mm-hmm. And there has got to be an exit strategy out of a conversation that will not have a conclusion mm-hmm. to it. And so what do you recommend for people when they, when there's just like, you know, you got to just like cut the anchor and drift away from it?
It totally depends on who you're talking to, but use some wrap-up language, the one I said before. You've given me a lot to think about. Thank you very much, and then just exit stage left, or just repeating back what they said to you as a final, and then saying, "All right, well, we'll talk to you later." You know, just getting out of there. So it really depends on who you're talking to, and there's different ways that you can wrap up. Do you have anything else you wanted to say? And sometimes that just puts a finality to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is tough. You know, that it's, I think it was in the book, there's the four agreements, then they have the fifth agreement. And the fifth agreement really goes into how we all are living in our own story. The story I have about me and my life and what it means, my purpose, all of that is my story. And you might not see any of that. And so understanding that the way that people see things, that's just really the way that they see it. Even if you so don't see it that way, or you're like, well, clearly that's not true. That's not real. That's not, you know, whatever. They believe stuff that's going on. You know, some of it, that's just politics. They're full of it. Other people, they really believe that. That's the story that they live in. And just understanding that might take the sting out of it when you can't get a resolution with someone else. When it's never, you're going around in circles and it's never going to change. Just knowing that that's the story that they live in, and there's nothing you can do to change that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a really great way to wrap this up, because, it is, you know, in every difficult conversation, not every difficult conversation has a nice tight, you know, pretty bow at the end of it there. And sometimes it is a matter of saying no. It's a matter of walking away from it, disengaging from it, not avoiding it, but learning how to have it, and then realize that, you know, that sometimes it is great if you're able to get everybody on the same page by understanding where everybody's personalities are coming into this and what everybody's really trying to achieve here. But then sometimes the best way to end a difficult conversation is just to leave it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, you have a website that people can go to, and you are a professional trainer when it comes to communications, because you are a communications nerd, as you've said. So how can people look you up and find out? And you have a show I want you to talk about and tell people about that they can come in and listen and get good information from you.
Yeah. So you can go to difficulthappens.com, and I work one-on-one with people in coaching and 6 and 9 month terms. And I also come in and do trainings. So if you have a high stress business in a small group and you want me to come in and talk to y'all about triggers and how to work together, especially how to work with your clients, you know, because when you are in a high stress field, your clientele comes to you already triggered at a heightened emotional state. And that can be difficult to deal with, especially for your frontline staff. Also, I've got the Difficult Happens podcast and my book, Difficult Happens, How Triggers, Boundaries, and Emotions Impact You Every Day. And if you want to know more on manipulation, I did a series. If you go to difficulthappens.com/, I think it's manipulate, I'll get you the link, that has all the podcast episodes talking about manipulative behavior and how to deal with it.
Cool. Awesome. Well, Laura, I love talking to you.
I always enjoy talking to you, and I can't wait to have you on my podcast next.
Awesome. Yes, this is not a difficult conversation with you. So,
yay.
Yeah, cool. So thank you for being on again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiricone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.